Jean-François Gravelet, better known as Blondine, was a famous tightrope walker and acrobat. He's perhaps best known for his many crossings of a tightrope, 1,100 feet in length, suspended 160 feet above Niagara Falls in the USA. His act would be watched by large crowds and begin with a relatively simple crossing using a balancing pole. Then he would throw away the pole and amaze the onlookers. On one occasion, he crossed the tightrope on stilts. On another occasion, blindfolded. Another time, he stopped halfway to cook and eat an omelette. In 1860, a royal party from England came to watch Blondin perform. After his normal spectacular crossings, he then wheeled a wheelbarrow from one side to the other as the crowd cheered. Next, he put a sack of potatoes into the wheelbarrow and wheeled that across. The crowd cheered louder. Then he approached the royal party and asked the Duke of Newcastle,
"Do you believe that I could take a man across the tightrope in this wheelbarrow?"
Yes, I do, said the Duke.
"Ah, hop in,"
replied Blondin. The crowd fell silent. But the Duke of Newcastle would not accept Blondin's challenge.
"Is there anyone else here who believes I could do it?"
asked Blondin. No one was willing to volunteer. Eventually, an old woman stepped out of the crowd and climbed into the wheelbarrow. Blondin wheeled her all the way across and all the way back. The old woman was Blondin's mother, the only person willing to put her life in his hands.
Thank you. Preachers have used this story for a long, long time. It's public domain forever. This was right around the beginning of the Civil War when this occurred. In fact, even Abraham Lincoln referenced Charles Blondin. It is told that, and he did this on several accounts, but at least on one of those accounts, there were 100,000 people watching him do this. And I got to thinking about this story and how it relates to our text today and the 4th of July. It's interesting that there are a lot of people there watching him and acknowledging that they believed in what he was doing and even believed that as far as what they claimed that he could wheel them across safely in a wheelbarrow. But when it came to commitment time, they all fell short except for his mother. They weren't willing to get into the wheelbarrow. They weren't willing to trust Charles Blondin with their lives. You know, and Charles was really asking everyone that day to get out of their comfort zone, to move beyond that, and take a risk and become vulnerable. I think it's easy in at least in Western culture, church, to get comfortable, to get a little too relaxed. We probably should just leave the air conditioning off sometimes. We probably should cause some discomfort every once in a while. Because everything is too predictable. You're used to me standing up over there, aren't you? And you're going, why is he sitting down over there? This is really different. We need some different. We need a little push. We need some help in our following of Jesus Christ so that we won't just be like those standing on the shores of Niagara Falls that day who were admirers. John chapter 6 is our text, verse 66. It's a pivotal verse in the New Testament. From that time, many of his disciples went back and walked with him no more. What happened? Up until that time, the people who claimed to be disciples, they've been having a pretty good time. They've been enjoying all the benefits of following the Lord. They sat down and they ate a lot of free food. They sat down and listened to a lot of free sermons and free teaching from Jesus. And they sat down and they watched a lot of people get healed. They saw lepers get healed and blind men that could see again and deaf men who could hear and crippled who could walk again. It was amazing. It was marvelous. No one had ever seen anything like that before because it had never happened before. And they got to enjoy all those benefits until John chapter 6 and verse 66. And something changed. You know what Jesus was saying to them in John chapter 6? Who will get into the wheelbarrow? That's what he was saying. Matt and I, we, you know, when preachers get together, we talk about church and all of our members. The good, the bad, and the ugly. And of course, neither of us have any bad or ugly in our churches. We have to reference other churches when we talk about that. But we just talk about different things, you know, really though, I mean, seriously, about church life today, not just in our church or churches, but I mentioned to him that the average attendance of admirer today, a Christian, is one Sunday out of six to come to church. One out of six is what we can count on. They tell us that if you get 2 hours a week out of a church member, you have got a person ready to be dubbed for sainthood. Wow. Has it always been like that? Is that what Jesus was talking about when he challenged his first disciples, one out of every six, 2 hours a week? No, that doesn't represent the wheelbarrow. So we'll get back to the words of Jesus in just a few moments. But I was challenged by one of the writers, opinion writers in Fox News, who is, used to work for Ronald Reagan, and so she's older, and right, and she challenged me to read the Declaration of Independence this morning, and I did, and interesting document, and thinking about it in our country, and of course we remember. We all are thinking about the last line, but you really need to read the whole thing. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And there were 56 men who signed this document. In fact, John Hancock said, "We'll all be hanged for this," after he signed, put his signature on the dotted line. And Benjamin Franklin said, "Well, we'll either all be hanged together or we'll all be hanged separately, but one of the two is coming." John Hancock, Matt pointed out to me this morning as we were talking about it, and I think we may have a picture of that. I want you to see this. Can you see his name on there? I wonder what John was trying to say to King George. You know, I think maybe he was trying to say, don't miss my name. Make sure you know I'm in the wheelbarrow when it comes to declaring independence from the crown of England. The oldest guy on that document is Benjamin Franklin at 70. The youngest guy, Edward, 26 years old, signed that document. Don't let anybody tell you that you're ever too young to serve the Lord and stand up for him and stand against the wiles of this world. These guys paid a heavy price for what they did. What was interesting about this document, too, is one of the guys in the group who didn't sign it, his name was John Dickinson. He was from Pennsylvania, Quaker. You know why he didn't sign it? He said, well, I'm not sure it's the right time. And he said, besides, the Spanish and the French could combine their forces with the British and come against us, and we would all be done. What's interesting about John is he did sign the Constitution. Huh. That's interesting. When all was safe, he was ready to sign. But when it was a time of being vulnerable and risky, when it was a time to get in the wheelbarrow, he just couldn't bring himself to it. As far as the other 56, get out of my way. Give me a pen and a piece of paper. I'm putting my name on it. Now, that's the heritage of our country. Now, fighting for freedom didn't stop with the end of the revolution. Because although we enjoyed this freedom, there were a lot of people trying to take it away from us. And Danny Davis forwarded me a little clip from the Wall Street Journal. And I'm going to read some of it to you. And Scott Johnson's the author. And as I was listening to Aaron preach the other day, it's good to sit out there in the audience, not be the preacher. And he was telling a story about somebody, and I thought, you know, it would be helpful if I saw the picture of the person that he was talking about, to have a visual. And so I'm going to have some pictures today talking about this thing about getting in the wheelbarrow for our country. He says, Scott says, in my own boyhood, figures such as Jimmy Doolittle and then John, this is Pat Tillman. I'm sorry, Linda. Pat Tillman used to play for the Cardinals in the NFL, and he turned down $1 million contract to join the service in order to fight for freedom, and he was killed with friendly fire. And the Marine Corporal Jason Dunham on April 22nd, 2004 was killed the same day. These are all Medal of Honor winners. Dunman, who saved several of his comrades in Iraq by falling on an insurgent's grenade, is the unknown soldier. The New York Times, y'all ever heard of that? Which featured Abu Ghraib on its front page for 32 consecutive days, put the story of Dunman's Medal of Honor on the third page of Section B. He goes on to write, then, in my own boyhood, figures such as Jimmy Doolittle and John Bassillone were household names. And it was assumed that what they had done defined us, as well as them telling us what kind of nation we were. But the 110 medal recipients alive today are virtually unknown, except for a niche audience of warfare buffs. There's something wrong with that, he says. like that about Jose Lopez. You know where Jose was from? San Antonio. Grew up in the barrio. He was in the Ardennes Forest when the Germans began the counteroffensive that became the Battle of the Bulge. As 10 enemy soldiers approached his position, he grabbed a machine gun, opened fire, killing them all. He killed 24 more who rushed him, knocked down by the concussion of German shells. He picked himself up, packed his weapon on his back, and ran toward a group of Americans about to be surrounded. He began firing and didn't stop till all his ammunition was gone. By then, he had killed over 100 of the enemy and brought his comrades time to establish a defensive line. Several Medal of Honor recipients told me that the first thing they did after the battle was to find a church. You see, it wasn't all about killing. Or some other secluded spot where they could pray, not only for their comrades, but for their enemies. Desmond Doss was a conscientious objector. He entered the army in 42, became a medic, and of course he was intimidated and threatened, and everybody was trying to get him a transfer out. He refused. They grudgingly accepted him, and late in 45, he was with them in Okinawa, where they were cut to pieces. Everyone but Mr. Doss retreated from the rocky plateau where dozens of wounded remained, and under fire he treated them and then began moving them one by one to a steep place where he roped them down to safety. And each time he succeeded, he prayed, "Dear God, please let me just get one more." Single-handedly, he saved 75 GIs. But for his age at 14, Jack Lucas begged his mother to help him enlist after Pearl Harbor. She finally relented. After training at Paris Island, he was sent to Honolulu. When his unit boarded a troop ship for Iwo Jima, he was ordered to remain behind for guard duty, but he stowed away to be with his friends, and discovered 2 days out at sea, convinced his commanding officer to put him in a combat unit rather than the brig. He had just turned 17 when he hit the beach. And a day later, he was fighting in a Japanese trench when two hand grenades landed near his buddies. He threw himself onto the grenades and absorbed the explosion. Later, a medic, assuming he was dead, was about to take his dog tags when he saw Jack's finger twitch. After months of treatment and recovery, he returned to school as he promised his mother a ninth grader wearing a Medal of Honor around his neck. But it wasn't just about World War II. There were others who tried to take our freedom away in Korea and later in Vietnam. One story that expresses this isolation involves a SEAL team ambushed on a beach after an aborted mission near North Vietnam's Cua Viet River base. After a five-hour gunfight, Commander Tom Norris, already a legend thanks to his part in a rescue mission for a downed pilot, stayed behind to provide covering fire while the three others headed to rendezvous with the boat sent to extract them. At the water's edge, one of the men, Mike Thornton, looked back and saw Tom Norris get hit. As the enemy moved in, he ran back through heavy fire and killed two North Vietnamese standing over Norris's body. He lifted the officer, barely alive, with a shattered skull and carried him to the water and swam out to sea where they picked up two hours later. The two men have been friends for the last 30 years. POWs of Vietnam had a tough time. John McCain tells of Lance Sejon, an airman ejected over North Vietnam and survived for 6 weeks crawling through the jungle before finally being caught close to death when he reached Hanoi. He told his captors he would give them no information. When not delirious, he quizzed his cellmates about camp security and made plans to escape. The Viet Cong were obsessed with breaking him, but never did. And when he died, after long sessions of torture, Sejong was, in Senator McCain's words, a free man from a free country. Leo Thorsness was also at the Hilton. An Air Force pilot had taken on four MiGs trying to strafe his buddy, his wingman, who had parachuted out of his damaged aircraft. He destroyed two and drove off the other two, but he was finally shot down himself. And they found out by tap code that he had been submitted for the medal. One of his most vivid memories from 7 years of imprisonment involved another prisoner by the name of Mike Christian. Our last story, who one day found a grimy piece of cloth, perhaps a former handkerchief during a visit to the nasty concrete tank where the POWs were occasionally allowed a quick sponge bath. Christian picked up the scrap of fabric and hid it. Back in his cell, he convinced prisoners to give him precious crumbs of soap so he could clean the cloth. And he stole a small piece of roof tile, which he laboriously ground into powder, mixed it with a bit of water, and used it to make horizontal stripes. He used one of the blue pills of unknown provenance the prisoners were given for all ailments to color a square in the upper left of the cloth. With a needle made from a bamboo wood and thread unraveled from the cell's one blanket, Christian stitched little stars on the blue field. It took Mike a couple of weeks to finish working at night under his mosquito net so the guards couldn't see him. Mr. Thorsness told Mike early one morning. He got up before the guards were active and held up a little flag, waving it as if it in a breeze. We turned to him and saw it coming to attention and automatically saluted. Some of us with tears running down our cheeks. Of course, the Vietnamese found it during a strip search. Took Mike to the torture cell and beat him unmercifully. Sometime after midnight, they pushed him into our cell so bad off that even his voice was gone. But when he recovered in a couple of weeks, he immediately started looking for another piece of cloth. Did that story bore you? I hope not. You know, that story talks about great commitment. And to a worthy cause, the place we live, called the United States of America. But how much greater a commitment should we have to the Christian flag, to the gospel of Jesus Christ, to the only remedy, the only redemption, the only method, the only way, the only door, the only escape for every person on this planet, and to be received with the Lord in heaven. You see, that's what got the people in John chapter 6. Because Jesus said, if you're going to follow me, you can't just enjoy the benefits. You've got to get in the wheelbarrow. Let me just describe for you what the wheelbarrow looks like. Jesus said, are you going to continue to lose your life? Are you going to continue to save your life? Or are you going to choose to lose it? Are you going to continue to just to indulge upon yourself? Or are you going to deny yourself the things that you want that are contrary to the will of God? Are you going to continue to just stay in the pig pen? Or will you get up and return to your Father? Will you just continue being an admirer? Or will you follow, being a fisher of men? Will you continue just serving yourself, or will you make the choice to serve the Lord? Will you continue lusting all through your life, or will you choose to stop it and express the love of God to those around you? Will you ever come out of the closet? Will you ever come out of the darkness? Or will you be like Nicodemus, who stole away to see Jesus by night so no one else would see him? In Luke chapter 9, it happened as they journeyed on the road that someone said to him, "Lord, I will follow you wherever you go." Big words. And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes, and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." He said to another, "Follow me." But he said, "But let me go first and bury my Father." Jesus said to him, "Let the dead bury their own dead. You go and preach the kingdom of God." And another said, "Lord, I will follow you, but let me first go and bid farewell." Lots of big words. Admirers. And we assume all three turned around and didn't follow the Lord. You see, Jesus, in his preaching and teaching, said there's a wheelbarrow for each of his disciples to get into. This morning in the early service, Carlos Gonzalez has been coming here since Easter Sunday of last year. This morning he walked down the aisle and he said, "Brother Mike, today I want to get into the wheelbarrow. I want to pledge my life to Jesus Christ and follow the Lord in believer's baptism." Would you like to pray with me for a moment as we close? Are you just an admirer? There's a cost to following Jesus Christ, and I'm here to tell you, it's worth any sacrifice. Don't stay on the sidelines. Walk through the narrow gate. Give your life to him. Let him have all of you, not just one Sunday out of six.